Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, the 17th of November, welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
For more than 20 years, the nation's homelessness strategy rested on a simple idea. Get people housed first, then help them stabilize. It was bipartisan. It was backed by research. And for thousands of Americans, it meant going from a sidewalk to a home. Well, today, that foundation is being torn up. The Trump administration has announced a sweeping overhaul of federal homelessness policy. They are shifting funding away from long-term permanent housing and towards short-term compliance-driven models that require treatment, sobriety, or work before people can keep a roof over their heads. And HUD will no longer automatically renew existing programs. And so today on the show, we're going to get a handle on this policy shift. We're going to look at what it could mean for the country, for cities like Philadelphia that have a housing first model, and for the future of homelessness policy. And we'll also hear a debate from a housing first advocate, as well as from a treatment first advocate. But we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road, or elsewhere. Our question of the day is, should there be work and drug requirements for homelessness services? Our number to participate is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can put those comments in the chat.
Again, the question, should there be work and drug requirements for homelessness services? 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org. One of those changes that maybe went under the radar when it happened last
week,
because there's so much going on in the news, but I'm glad that we're able to focus in on this today and hopefully have an enlightening conversation. Again, 888-477-9499, studio2@whyy.org. Before all of that, of course, as always, our trio of local news stories.
And you're kicking us off today.
I'm kicking us off. So there's bad news about SEPTA. Not that bad news we talked about last week with the rail cars that need to be inspected. This has to do with some labor strife. SEPTA's largest union, Transit Workers Union Local 234, has authorized a strike. That doesn't mean a strike will happen, but it's on the table as this union tries to negotiate a two-year contract. They've been on a series of one-year contracts for the last 3 years. And if you recall, last year, about exactly a year ago, they came very close to a strike, but they got a one-year extension done with SEPTA. This is the union that represents bus, subway, and trolley operators. So if this union strikes, it would seriously impact the system. Mm-hmm. Negotiations are ongoing, even as the old contract expired 10 days ago. What this latest move does is it allows the union to strike if they feel like they're not making progress with SEPTA. So that's now hovering on the horizon.
Yeah, and all of this comes on the heels of SEPTA getting exactly zero new dollars in the recently negotiated state budget. Another blow to SEPTA, and, you know, no new money, no permanent solution for how to fund SEPTA. So the can was kicked down the road yet again. And the patch they agreed to, you know, taking money from those capital funds, that will expire, in about a year and a half.
Yeah.
That was only a 2-year fix. And so when it rains, it pours. I mean, SEPTA has been dealing with, and we reported on the show, they're dealing with these federal inspections of their rail cars, you know, cancellations for a couple of weeks because those inspections were going on. And now this. And I wanted to sort of flag something that we've heard about. But SEPTA unions have walked off the job at least 12 times since 1975. And it's become one of the most strike prone big transit agencies in the country. So the last thing they need is a strike. So hopefully they can work something out.
Yeah. And when there's scarcity, there's often labor strife, and there's clearly scarcity here. And the riders are caught in the middle. And, you know, I was, you know, I like to go on Reddit sometimes, see what people are talking about. And there was a really popular post maybe yesterday in the Philly subreddit of a guy, I think it was a guy saying, I'm a huge SEPTA supporter. I've ridden it for a long time and I just can't do it anymore. It's just not reliable enough. I'm going to Uber and Lyft. And this was someone who, like, ideologically, fundamentally wants to support SEPTA. So when you're losing or you're frustrating or you're alienating that type of rider, it's a hard road back from there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Second story, New Jersey lawmakers want retailers to tell consumers how much they are paying for tariffs. A new bill was introduced by Democratic lawmakers in both the New Jersey Assembly and the Senate that would force retailers to disclose the portion of the cost of a product, attributed to tariffs. They want it on tags, they want it on receipts, and they want it on online product pages.
So if your banana was like 80 cents, it would say it's 6 cents higher because of tariffs.
Because of tariffs, yeah. Or if you were buying something online, you could see, okay, that if there were no tariffs, it would only cost $29.99, yeah, not $36, or
right,
whatever the price is.
Right.
Now, of course, this is Democrats' latest response to the Trump administration tariffs. They argue that retailers are simply passing on the tariff costs to consumers, and consumers have the right to know that they are the ones paying for these tariffs, and they need to know exactly how much they're paying. And it is, though, being criticized as unworkable by the New Jersey Business and Industry Association. This is a group that has been critical of the tariffs, but they say that this is complicated. It's gonna cause all kinds of problems.
It's a burden on the retailer to try to figure out exactly how much of a price increase is attributable to tariffs.
And why? Because a lot of our products go through multiple countries.
Yeah.
So they have to consider tariffs from the other countries before it's imported in the U.S., and they said it's going to be a mess.
Yeah. Feels like a slippery slope, too, if we try to start isolating why every product is as expensive as it is. Because I could see someone going back and saying, well, why don't you factor out how much of this is due to, you know, government taxes on business? Like, you could do this. You could split this hair a lot of different ways.
I will say this. If there are these fast fashion, and I went on a website where you get your clothes shipped in from China, uh-huh, right? And once you put in an American address, you can see the difference in the price.
There you
so
go.
That you could say, oh, that must be tariffs, right? If it's, you know, $9, and then I click, you know, once you know my address, it's $14.
Yeah. Right.
There's
and
that.
In that case, the retailer's incentivized to show you.
Exactly.
Yeah, because they're trying to make a point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like tough to say, like, businesses, we know you're being burdened by tariffs. Here's another burden. You have to figure out exactly how much tariff you're passing.
Go do some calculations.
That's just a tough sell.
Calculations.
It's a tough sell. Okay, story number three. Roommate disputes, Cherry.
Mm-hmm.
Not unusual. Who did the dishes last?
Absolutely.
Who finished the peanut butter?
Mm.
But a pair of Philadelphia roommates had a dispute so intense, it resulted in a court case that cost $25,000 in legal fees.
Cha-ching.
And the object of their dispute is a cat.
Ooh.
Named Gary.
Meow.
Gary the cat. Fantastic reporting by The Inquirer about these roommates. They're named Jessica and Nicole. Mm-hmm. They started rooming together a few years back. Jessica already had this cat named Gary. Mm-hmm. And so Gary and Jessica moved in with Nicole. Nicole really, really liked Gary.
Mm, fell in
love. In fact, they both really, really like Gary. When Jessica moved out in 2024, she actually left Gary behind for a little bit because she had some housing transition that she was going through. And Nicole felt like Gary at that point had been gifted to her. Jessica said,
No.
Gary is still my cat. And she sued.
Mm.
The case went on for a while, and it cost $25,000 in legal fees. I know you want to know the conclusion. The conclusion is that Jessica, Gary's original owner, was awarded full custody of Gary the cat.
So interesting.
$25,000 in legal fees.
Yeah.
And it's a cute cat. I'll tell you, it's a really cute cat.
It is a really cute cat. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Whenever you have a pet with a human name, there's going to be problems.
What?
And Gary.
When have you said that before?
Gary has just caused problems.
When have you said that before?
I've said that. I say that to everybody.
You're consistent on that.
I'm consistent on that.
I've
I had
never
a cat named
said
Lucy. She was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, caused problems. Okay. So, but look at how cute
Gary
is.
I'm sorry. I can't let you continue because we're on this now. you're saying that they cause problems because people start to view them as more human-like
yes,
than they are.
Yes, they do. And okay. Gary, look at those blue eyes. Look at how cute he is. I'm going to call him G-Money because he was so expensive. He got these ladies who used to travel together. They had matching alien tattoos.
Yeah,
all of a sudden, they're so upset and in love with Gary that they go to court and fight over Gary.
See, I'm not blaming the cat here.
I'm blaming the cat.
I'm not blaming the cat. I'm not blaming the name of the cat. I think this goes to one of the most complicated relationships in the whole spectrum of human relationships, which is the roommate relationship. That's just a tough relationship. It's very intimate on one hand, but if you try to turn it into a friendship or something more, then it becomes really messy and complicated. That's a tough balance, the roommate relationship.
And then you throw a cute cat in there.
It's a ticking time bomb.
Named Gary.
It's a ticking time bomb.
I mean...
Yeah, that's an unstable element to throw into an already unstable relationship.
And people love their cats, man. Americans, we love our pets. Don't play with us.
Roommate relationships are tough.
Yeah.
Cat relationships are tough. We're going to make a very stark transition now to the topic of today's show, which is about homelessness in America and the best way to address it. We want to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Our country's approach to homelessness may be on the verge of a sea change. Last week, the Trump administration unveiled a new plan for doling out billions in federal aid. For years, much of this money went toward long-term housing.
Now, a lot of those dollars will go toward transitional models, the kind of programs that last less than 2 years. And the government will prioritize providers who have strict requirements around work and substance abuse treatment.
At the heart of this bureaucratic change is a deep ideological divide over how to curb homelessness. We're going to get into that debate a little later in the hour, and we really want to hear from you. Should there be work and drug requirements for homelessness services? What do you think? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, hello, drop a comment in the chat.
And as we wait to hear from you, we'll get some clarity on the Trump administration's new funding policy. Our guide is Jennifer Ludden, national correspondent for NPR, covering housing and homelessness. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Jennifer, what's the quick and dirty explanation of what changed with this latest Trump administration policy? What was the before and what was the after?
So it's a massive shift of federal dollars. Before, for a while now, most of nearly $4 billion, $3.5 to $4 billion, has gone to getting people off the streets and into long-term, really permanent housing and subsidized housing. They may pay part of the rent, but it's subsidized. And then it offers them support services. It's called permanent supportive housing. And there's drug treatment, mental health counseling, job help finding jobs available, but it's not mandated, it's voluntary. And advocates of this system will say, look, the U.S. actually had a lot of sober housing and more required treatment in the past. And they say it didn't really work. You can't really force someone to do this. They have to want to do it. And they cite years of research that it has a fairly good track record of keeping people off the street long term. The new now is that most of that funding is going to go from 90% to 30% of HUD's budget. And a lot more is going to be spent on, like you said, transitional housing up to 2 years. And the government is going to favor, they have like little points in the budget plan or in the plan where you can apply for funding. They're going to favor places that do impose work requirements and treatment for either addiction or mental health counseling. And the government, the HUD says this is to promote self-sufficiency and to try and get what they see as the root causes of this rise in homelessness, a real rise. We've seen record highs after record highs in the past few years, especially since the pandemic, and a big increase in street homelessness.
Yeah. And when I think about this, I think about, can you tell us a little bit about the timing of this rollout and what it means for programs that have relied for years on this housing first model?
Definitely a lot of concern in the community. I've spoken to national advocates. I've spoken to someone who runs a local operation in Los Angeles, and they are worried that they're not going to see their funding renewed because a lot of this funding, while they apply every year or two, it's been likely that you'll get refunded. You've got a program that's going, you have hundreds of people housed, and you were likely to see that rolled over. And now clearly the government says, we want some new players at the table. We want to expand who is offering services, different kinds of services. And so I spoke with a woman at LA Family Housing in Los Angeles who says she just does not know what will happen. She is going to have to scramble to figure out, is there different kind of funding if she doesn't get this money? And the concern is that, we also have an affordable housing shortage, a massive shortage of affordable housing. Rents have gone sky high. There's many median middle income people who struggle to pay rent. And so if you're taking someone who has been homeless, chronically homeless, we're talking about chronically homeless people, formerly chronically homeless people, many with some disabling condition, to then expect them to go and find a job that will pay, theoretically a market rate rent, that they say it's very difficult. It's a very big ask.
And so if I'm a person and I have my housing is subsidized by an organization that's been getting money from HUD, from the federal government for a long time, and that organization stops getting money, it's possible that what, I would lose my housing, I would have to go to a program with another organization that has a different model. Like we're talking the people who are kind of caught in the tides of this, is there a sense of what might happen to them?
There's concern that people will lose their housing and maybe end up on the street, maybe have to go to more shelters, and the advocates I've spoken with say, if you want to ramp up transitional housing, that's great. I mean, generally speaking, the sense is the country could use more of everything, but where they take a big issue is when you're doing that at the expense of long-term housing. And their idea is that, look, the whole point of is to end homelessness. We have a housing shortage, an affordable housing shortage. So we've been trying to ramp up a long-term affordable housing and where people can stay, and you are in that long process trying to end homelessness. Whereas if you, and then if the option is more short-term stays where people maybe will be forced to, address some problems they have, there's not enough of them currently available. Certainly not enough treatment currently available, advocates say, for this sudden switch in funding. Like the money, she says, the money's going to go to something that doesn't exist right now. This transition can't happen in at the flip of a switch.
And I wonder, did the Trump administration sort of lay out its rationale for this drastic shift? And because you kind of have to explain something like this, and is there any kind of leeway or runway to give organizations an opportunity to make the shift?
It seems like the funding shift they want to happen pretty fast. They just put out the notice last week and people are going to start applying, I believe in January for the funding. So that's pretty fast. But the I would say that there's been a backlash building for a number of years. You suggested there's is this ideological difference. For a long time, getting people into housing was a very bipartisan idea. It goes back to the George W. Bush administration. But I think that there's been a lot of conservatives who've questioned this and really blamed it in part for the spike in homelessness that we've seen, especially since the pandemic. More than 700,000 people in this country on a given night, according to federal estimates, are homeless, and that's widely seen as an undercount. And about a quarter million of them are actually unsheltered, so living outside or in cars. And so I think in the pandemic, we also have seen this rise of outdoor homelessness. Communities are grappling with this. This is an issue that what people may recall went all the way to the Supreme Court. What do cities do with homeless encampments in public parks and streets? So a lot of communities are grappling with this, and I think that has really fueled the backlash to what has been happening slowly, steadily, but clearly hasn't stopped this rise in homelessness, which again, advocates would point to spiking rents. And so there's sort of this debate about what's really at heart, at the core issue, and what's the right way to address it.
And because you alluded to it there, I'm just curious how this policy will pair with policies that the Trump administration has rolled out or hinted at around like clearing encampments and addressing sort of proximally street homelessness, people who are unsheltered. Like, what are the other moves that the Trump administration is making in this space, and how might those work with or against what we're talking about today?
So actually, there is actually another piece of this new funding policy that is very related. So
Yep.
in addition to switching the money, there are also new points, new things that the administration says it will favor when it hands out this money. It's going to favor places in the country and programs that align with the Trump administration policies. So, for example, places that enforce a ban on homeless encampments and really work to get them off the street. Also, policies around DEI, opposition to transgender rights, to harm reduction. You know, the administration does not agree with harm reduction policies that are meant to keep people safe, even if they may still be using illicit drugs, you know, needle exchanges, for example. So it wants to use its leverage in funding to kind of force communities to align with other parts of its agenda
That's
as
a pretty
well.
broad spectrum of policies you laid out there, some of which we would associate more with homelessness and homelessness policy, and others that seem at best secondarily related. But they're all going to be considered now in terms of who should be prioritized for this money. That's what you're saying, Jennifer.
That's what's in this. People have raised the question of whether this is legal, whether there might be a lawsuit. There was a different funding around a very specific smaller pool of money in the homelessness space that did get challenged in the court, but we're just going to have to see.
A quick follow-up on this. You know, one of the things that stood out to me in this new policy rollout is that involuntary commitments was going to be a part of this for people who are dealing with severe mental health issues. I wonder if there's anything else in the Trump administration that is going to roll out to support that, because, you know, we don't necessarily have mental health beds for people. So is there going to be more funding to support an increase in involuntary commitments? Have you seen that?
Right. So the funding does encourage people to offer this. That's, you know, the funding is hoping that more treatment and transitional housing and places that offer these things will come. How quickly that can happen is an open question. And for sure, as you say, there's just not enough programs and treatments available right now. You have seen some states move in this area. There's a lot of movement, and it's bipartisan. You know, New York and other states have tried to encourage more involuntary commitment in some situations. So that is a real big issue in a lot of places. And this is sort of the government trying to put money behind that. But again, the question is how long that might take.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for getting us set up today on Studio 2. Really important background information. That's Jennifer Ludden, national correspondent for NPR covering housing and homelessness. Thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're going to read a couple comments.
Yeah, let's get one from Jai here who says, "You can't expect stability from someone who doesn't have a stable place to sleep. Housing first works because it gives people the foundation they need to actually address addiction, mental health, employment, and everything else." Mora also says on Facebook, "I do believe there should be requirements, but the problem is those systems are also broken and already don't help the homeless population." And here's one from Nen from Princeton, New Jersey, who says, "Simply, the winter and cold doesn't care if someone is in treatment. Give them housing first."
Yes. So for the rest of this hour, we're going to debate the best approaches to homelessness. Dennis Cole Hain is a leading voice among those who support Housing First initiatives, the kind of initiatives that now stand to lose federal money. He is a professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dennis, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us via Zoom is Devin Kurtz, Public Safety Policy Director at the Cicero Institute. He supports this latest shift on housing policy. Devin, thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And so, Dennis and Devin, I want each of you to sort of lay out your positions. And Dennis, we'll start with you. Explain to us this Housing First policy and why you say it works.
Well, Housing First was created because we had a system in place of transitional housing, much like the proposal calls for, that had sobriety requirements, treatment requirements, and it largely failed
And when was this? Give us a sense.
I would say basically from the late 80s up until the federal law officially changed in 2009.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
We went to a housing first policy, but it was shifting in the interim. But basically, the policy led to huge turnover at the front end of the system because people didn't comply with the clean and sober requirements. We're talking about some people who have longstanding addictions, and you can say, we want you to comply with clean and sober requirements, doesn't mean it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So a very small number of people would actually be able to sustain and graduate from these programs. And the irony is that the people who did finally graduate 2 years later from these programs were the highest functioning people who didn't need it. So most of the money went to the people who needed it the least, and the people who needed the more intensive services were back on the street.
And what's your evidence that that didn't work? Mm-hmm.
There was a number of studies that looked at transitional housing and found them to be very expensive, ineffective. And, you know, so the federal government said, we got to change this up, as well as we knew that Housing First, which we did experimental studies comparing people going into transitional housing versus Housing First, showed much higher success rates, like 85%.
And so explain what Housing First means. It means no requirements for work. No. Explain exactly what it means.
Well, there are different philosophies and different programs, but essentially the idea is that you have the assurance of access to housing, usually through a subsidy. But it's not housing only. People are engaged in services from the very outset. There are mobile teams, case managers, peer support who meet with people. They're supposed to do so on a regular basis. And they're engaging you in the treatment process. You may need a hospitalization. You may need to go into residential treatment. You may need to go into a job training program, what have you. But having a place to live creates the foundation for a person to feel secure, to be able to go along with the requirements of recovery. And so it just showed far superior outcomes. And, of course, it's much less expensive. Mm-hmm. Paying someone's rent is a lot, and providing mobile support costs about $25,000 per person per year, where when you're looking at a treatment facility, it's going to be $65,000 to $75,000 a year. So you're going to be able to serve far fewer people, less effectively. So it was pretty clear. There was a wide consensus in the research community and the policy community, bipartisan on Capitol Hill, to support a shift to a housing first strategy.
And before we get to Devin, just real quick, though. So if someone is being serviced by sort of a housing first provider, they're given some sort of rent subsidy and as a result have a place to live, and they choose never to seek further treatment for substance use disorder, or they choose never to seek employment, they're going to keep that housing.
Well, generally speaking, but if they are having an active substance use issue, they may get evicted from that housing. Mm-hmm. About 15% of the people who get placed in a Housing First program do not succeed in that program. They need more structure. Usually they need a higher level of care. Sometimes they need a nursing home. Sometimes they need something more structured.
So it's not without conditions, I guess, is what I'm saying.
So you can't go in there and actively use drugs in one of these places. That would not work.
Correct. If you're disruptive to your neighbors and your landlord, you're going to get evicted, and that happens. So sometimes people have to move to a place where they might be in more structured with 24-hour, 7 staff, where there might be a dozen apartments. So you have scattered site, people in everyday apartments that all of us live in, or you would be in a building that might be dedicated for this purpose, in which case there's going to be more on-site support services as well. So you may have to progress into a higher level of care in order to be able to sustain, because otherwise, you know, you're back homeless. And that does happen. About 3% of the people who go into a Housing First program return to homelessness. Most of the people who don't succeed, of that 15%, most of them are going into a higher level of care.
Okay. All right.
So Devin, I want to bring you in the conversation now. Devin Kurtz, from Public Safety Policy Director at the Cicero Institute. So you're a critic, I believe, of Housing First policies and initiatives. So what do you think has not worked about Housing First, and what would you like to see it replaced with?
I think it's important to go back to this discussion of the evidence base of Housing First and when that evidence started to emerge. We're talking about the 1990s, the 2000s. A lot of the studies that Professor Culhane is referencing come from a period that I would say has a different composition of homelessness than we have today. It's notably before These new forms of methamphetamine that Sam Quinones writes about in his coverage for the LA Times of this. And most importantly, it's before fentanyl really is you know, I would say the leading drug on our streets. So things are different from certainly the 90s, certainly from 2009. And I think that that's really important when we're talking about substance abuse treatment specifically. There's a mental health component as well. Those are not always entangled, but sometimes they are. So I'd like to start with the National Academy of Sciences and their review of Housing First programs. This is back in 2018. And they actually challenged the belief among Housing First advocates that Housing First improved health outcomes. You heard Professor Culhane describe it as this foundation upon which homeless individuals can then start to work on treatment, start to work on different forms of physical health as well. We actually don't see that bearing out in the evidence. They did a systematic review and didn't find any evidence other than for homeless individuals with HIV, which is a less than 2% of the homeless population. So for the vast majority of homeless, we did not see an improvement in health outcomes due to Housing First. Most recently, there was a randomized controlled trial in Denver. And I've cited this one a lot because it was described, much like Professor Culhane did, as a huge success. I think it was over 85% housing retention, just as we were discussing. The problem was that if we look at the uptake of substance abuse treatment, it did not increase in the Housing First group. If we look at physical health, also was not an uptake in services. There was a marginal uptake in services for serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia and psychosis. But most of the mental health uptake was for anxiety and PTSD. And then finally, the mortality rates in that were very concerning. For 4 years, it had a significantly, or I shouldn't say significantly, but it's at such a rare event that it didn't reach statistical significance, but a substantial increase in mortality in the Housing First group for 4 years in a row, such that by the end of 4 years, it was actually a 50% higher mortality rate in Housing First. So all this is to say, it doesn't work for everybody. And the changes we've seen with the federal government is not to say that housing isn't part of the solution. It's that it can't be the only solution. I would push back on this idea that services have been integrated into Housing First models. At scale, I don't think that it has.
And so what would a treatment first, or what would the proposal that the Trump administration has, what would that look like if you were to roll that out?
So I think, you know, Jennifer was mentioning earlier that the expectation is that this happens quickly. And I would like us to remember that we went through this before. Professor Culhane mentioned the HEARTH Act 2009 that was implemented in full by HUD by 2013. But even then, we've seen over 11 years a change from transitional housing to permanent support housing. There was about 285,000 transitional housing units in 2013. By 2018, that had changed by about 100,000 units. And now we're down about 60% from that high. And we've seen 120,000 units decline from transitional housing and 120,000 units in permanent supportive housing increase. But that took over 10 years to get there. So I don't think this is an overnight change. And I think that in terms of integrating treatment, I mean, HUD spends $170 million a year on supportive services. Medicaid spends $75 billion on mental health and substance abuse treatment. This entire population would be eligible for Medicaid. And then SAMHSA has block grants for substance abuse and mental health that should be prioritized to this population. The problem is that a lot of these programs haven't been prioritized to them because in large part, the homelessness advocates have not prioritized it. They've said we should fund housing first, not necessarily the program Housing First, but this idea that housing is the top priority. And, you know, Jennifer mentioned that we should also be funding all sorts of housing. That's not what we've heard from advocates out in the states. You know, most of my time is with state legislatures. And every time that we advocate for transitional housing or for treatment, it's put in direct opposition with housing proposals. So I would push back on a lot of that.
All right. So we've set out, I think, the baseline here, both positions. We're going to dig a little more on the other side of this break. We want to continue to hear from you this hour. We want to know, should there be work and drug requirements for homelessness services? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And we'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about homelessness and whether or not there should be work and drug requirements for homelessness services. With us in studio is Dennis Culhane, professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Also, we have joining us remotely Devin Kurtz, public safety policy director at the Cicero Institute.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. Should there be work and drug requirements for homelessness services? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Drop a comment in the chat. And one more thing I wanted to clear up with you, Devin, before we kick it back to Dennis. So I know every program's a little bit different, but I still think maybe our listeners could use some clarity around what a model might look like. Mm-hmm. So let's imagine you have someone who's unhoused. They enter a program where there's a requirement around substance use addiction treatment. And so, and they have a documented problem here. So they go into the program and let's say it's an 18-month program or something like that. And how does it work? They can basically stay in that program as long as they continue to go to treatment. They have to demonstrate progress. Like what typical requirement look like? And then if they don't meet that, what happens?
Yeah, I think this is where the notice of funding opportunity is essentially a rubric that rewards certain types of programs and program components. The reality is that 30% is still going to be directed towards permanent supportive housing. And for that remainder, what it means to integrate treatment and services into what is currently the most, the bulk of the housing stock for these programs is permanent supportive housing and rapid rehousing. I think that's going to look different in different places. I think that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel. We're trying to emphasize treatment and services in a way that in our view in the last 10 years, it hasn't been. So sure, some of that's going to be a typical transitional housing model where it is, certain services and treatment are integrated directly into housing on site, but some of it could be utilization of assisted outpatient treatment. We mentioned civil commitment earlier, and I think that that's a model for that doesn't require inpatient psychiatric beds. Some communities are considering doing it for substance abuse as well. That could be integrated as part of the housing model. It wouldn't be that necessarily the treatment is strictly conditioned on, say, the voucher or on the housing. But for those who already have leases in some of these programs, very likely it would be utilization of something like assisted outpatient treatment, which is a court order for treatment. And that has been shown to be quite successful, actually, and is a way that the executive order back in July, released by the Trump administration, also encouraged communities to do this. So I think there's a variety of ways that it can be done, depending on the needs of the individual.
Yeah, and Dennis, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of the things that Devin was talking about.
Well, first, I think we should not confound people's housing needs with their treatment needs. Mm-hmm. We don't do that for the general population. We should not do that for people who are homeless. The purpose of homeless assistance programs is to get people out of homelessness. The purpose of our healthcare programs is to help people improve their health. And so, no, we don't expect placement in housing first is going to cure mental illness. It's not going to stop people from using substances. Most people with mental illness or who are substance users actually live in apartments and homes now. So I think we don't want to confound those two objectives. And the primary objective of the homeless assistance program should be getting people out of homelessness.
Right. That's the big question here. But it's like, what's the goal here?
Right.
So Devin was talking about how there was some recent evidence from some studies that it does not improve health outcomes. You're saying that's not the primary goal
here. No, it is not. The primary goal is to get these very vulnerable, often very sick and frail people off the street where they are dying on the street.
And so why has the population of unhoused people increased over this period of time when that has been the explicit primary goal of the sort of the government subsidy program?
Well, the main challenge with Housing First has been its scalability. Mm-hmm. Only 16% of the people who become homeless will actually exit to a Housing First program, whether mm-hmm. that's rapid rehousing or permanent supportive housing. We simply don't have enough slots. So the number of people coming in very often exceeds the number of people going out. Okay. Yeah. So that's when you see these increases, in particular around chronic homelessness, because the number of exit opportunities, the housing placements, are not available. Mm-hmm. But we have a very important counterpoint here. Yeah. And that is the example of the veteran homeless population, mm-hmm. where we did achieve scale. 65% of people who are veterans and homeless this year who need rapid rehousing will get it. Half of the people who need permanent supportive housing will get it within 1 year. So we have come much closer to scale when it comes to the veteran population, and we had a 55% decline in veteran homelessness from 2010 to 2017.
There's more money there.
Because there's more
tremendous more money
and actual housing.
Tremendous more money.
And my question to you, Dennis, is this, and I want to sort of have you respond to a specific criticism that Devin had, and that is, you know, things are different than the way they were when Housing First came on board, that, you know, we weren't dealing with an opioid addiction. We didn't have these, you know, these encampments of people who were visibly facing substance use disorder. How do you respond to that? And that this has become a critical situation where just offering housing is not enough, that you have to give some kind of nudge to get people into treatment.
Well, we have involuntary commitment statutes in every state in the country. There is the opportunity to involuntarily commit people to a healthcare setting for being a danger to themselves or to others. That's a necessary tool in the toolbox. But the opiate crisis really peaked in 2012, 2013. Mm. It has sustained, and we've had an increase in methamphetamine and other drugs. We do have some effective medications and treatment for people with opioid disorders, and we should be applying those. But again, we have healthcare treatment issues. We need bed capacity for people with substance abuse treatment. We need inpatient mental health capacity for those folks. We do not need to take the money out of the homeless system and evict essentially 170,000 people who will potentially lose their housing because they're not in one of these programs that's compliant with this treatment orientation.
And Devin, I want you to respond to that claim, because that's a big one. You know, a lot of organizations that have been Housing First for years, very nervous because of the funding criteria shifts. Could we see large thousands and thousands of people who are now housed losing housing because of this policy shift?
No. No, I reject the framing of this as eviction of 170,000 disabled people, as the National Alliance to End Homelessness claimed. And this is for a couple of reasons. The first is that I actually think it's a very important point that Dennis raised around the exits from the homelessness system. Housing First has designed a system in which, outside of rapid rehousing, which is what, 36 months typically, most people don't exit. Most people stay in this housing for, I think Ann Oliva mentioned this, she's the head of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, in a New York Times article, 5 to 8 years. The fact that we've designed a system where no one actually does get better and reach self-sufficiency is the central problem that we see HUD trying to solve. And I want to focus in on this framing of this population as disabled. HUD's definition of disabled is not the same as the ADA. The Americans with Disability Act is actually quite narrow in its definition of disability. HUD has a totally different one. Namely, it includes substance abuse, which has been a rising portion of the unsheltered homeless population that's suffering from this. We've seen the same thing with mental health. The system we've designed is failing this population the most. It is, you know, for some of them, getting them into housing, but then never actually giving them the support they need to reach any level of self-sufficiency, which then clogs the system and prevents people from being able to access it who may actually have an ADA disability and are not there for substance abuse, but are there because they're paralyzed or because they're a veteran. So I think that there's a need to see this as a system flow. Some people do need to flow out of the system. It doesn't mean they don't need support. It just means we have to consider how long that support should be for in proportion to their needs.
Dennis, your response to this idea that people by design are getting sort of stuck in the permanent, semi-permanent housing system, and that there's really no incentive or there's really no sort of conveyor belt moving them to self-sufficiency.
Well, that's not actually my main point. A lot of these people are permanently disabled. And 5 to 8 years for someone who has a permanent disability, most of these people are actually quite older at this point. And, you know, substance abuse does count as a disability in some definitions, as he's mentioned. It was the Republican welfare reform in 1997 that cut substance abuse from eligibility for disability. And because it's not a permanent disability, but you were eligible for some income from the SSI program. And we had an increase in homelessness as a result of cutting SSI from eligibility for people with substance abuse. I think, first of all, the other thing I want to pull back on is just to say, you know, the homeless population is much more diverse than we're talking about.
Yeah.
20 to 25% are children. Most of them are preschool age children. Another 10 to 12% are the parents of those children, mostly mothers, and who are unemployed. We have youth who are another potentially 5 to 10% of the population, many of whom are people who have emancipated from foster care and fall into homelessness on occasion. The single adult population, let's talk about that flow. The focus here we've been having is on the chronically homeless population. That's really 10 to 15% of the people who come into homelessness. It's actually exceptional, even though on a given day, they may account for half of the people who are homeless and on the street. Over the course of a year, let's take the city of Philadelphia. Philadelphia will have 15,000 people who will stay in a homeless shelter this year, okay? But when we do our one-night count, we have like about 900, it's 800 people who are on the street. Maybe 300 of those people are in Kensington, which is sort of the highly visible population. Yeah. So we should not let the high visibility of people with these chronic substance use issues to stand in and represent the 15,000 people who are coming into homelessness.
But let me just, I guess, maybe, and Devin, you'll correct me if I'm framing this wrong, but I think maybe what I'm sensing from the opponents of the critics of Housing First is that there's a complacency that has settled in, which is that because there is such an intense focus on housing and sort of an infinite horizon on that housing, that incentive structure is not there to get people through it to the other side, which I would imagine is the goal, right? For people who can, is to get them to a place where they are
no longer dependent on the subsidy.
Yeah.
Correct. But look, at the word dependence on a subsidy for people who are very low income, whose income is SSI.
Yeah.
We're talking about a maximum of like $900 a month. They are not going to be able to afford an apartment with a subsidy. Mm-hmm. We have to always be increasing. We have an affordability crisis.
Yeah.
And the essence of solving the housing affordability crisis is rental assistance. And even with people who are employed, 46% of the single adult homeless population, people who come into homelessness, are employed concurrent with their homelessness.
Mm.
Okay. So again, not the chronic homeless population, but many people, including the rapid rehousing population, which has been mentioned, it's designed, it's only 2 years maximum in most cases. Most people use it for 6 to 8 months and they go back into the labor market. So it is incorrect to argue that most of the people getting this assistance are not, in fact, going into jobs and on their own. The rapid rehousing population is nearly entirely going into jobs and housing on their own and into self-sufficiency.
I want to bring in a caller. We only have a few minutes left, and I'm going to try to jam this person in. Charlene from Philadelphia is on the line. Charlene, you're on Studio 2. We only have like 2 minutes left in the show, so could you keep it brief? But we want to include your perspective. Charlene, what's your question or comment?
Yeah, sure. Hi. And I concur with everything that Dr. Culpane has said. The first thing is that from the moment folks are targeted for housing, for those limited resources, they're in services. They're being engaged by outreach teams, by medical providers. And for the service providers, even though there's this term voluntary services, for the service providers, their job is to make sure that 100% of the folks in housing are participating and engaging in services, which can take a while. Folks do that at various paces in their lives. The second thing is communities for a very long time have targeted this housing to those who need it the most. So those are folks who are aging, who are physically disabled, who have substance use issues. That's one of the reasons, obviously, we see people die in housing. And we're talking about by name lists. And those statistics, that data is reported to HUD annually. So I think homelessness is one of the best researched social problems that we have.
Thank you. Charlene from Philadelphia.
As we get ready to wrap up, Devin, I mean, I guess one of my questions for you is, what is the evidence that this new model will work if it seems to have failed in the past? You're saying there's been a change in the types of, in sort of the demographics of the homelessness population, and therefore this old model revived and reformatted could work, but sort of in 30 seconds, what's the evidence for that?
We're not going back. We're going forward, and we're going to integrate new models that involve things like, you know, long-acting antipsychotics, things that were not widely used the last time that we were using these models. So I think that the horizon for our service interventions, for our treatment interventions, for our criminal justice interventions, public health interventions has changed in the 15 years since we tried to scale this model. So I don't think it's going back to 2005. It's rather looking at the toolkit we've gotten after a decade and a half of good information from some of the successes of Housing First, but also some of the gaps. The priority for HUD right now is to fill in those gaps.
All right. Well, we do have to leave the conversation there, but I want to thank you both for being here today. And also Jennifer Ludden was with us earlier. You just heard there from Devin Kurtz, Public Safety Policy Director at the Cicero Institute. Devin, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And you also heard from Dennis Culhane, Professor of Social Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much, Dennis,
for checking in with us
here at Studio 2.
And I wanted to read this comment from Matt, who emailed. He says, housing versus treatment is a false choice because it assumes that people experiencing homelessness all have addiction issues. Many, in fact, maybe most, have lost their homes due to job loss, relationship issues, evictions, and more. Just wanted to point out, not everybody is dealing with addiction. I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. How
Manana.
About that? Yes.